Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, the political terrain shifts again. In Poland, Donald Tusk calls a vote of confidence in response to his candidate's defeat in the presidential elections. And in the Netherlands, the coalition government collapses after far-right leader Geert Wilders withdraws in response to a row over immigration. All that, plus the bizarre and brutal case of France's crypto entrepreneur kidnappings. That's all here on Inside Europe. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. June 11th, that's the date on which the fate of Donald Tusk's government will be decided, and with it, the future direction of Poland. The Polish Prime Minister called a vote of confidence following the defeat of his coalition's candidate, Warsaw Mayor Rafał Trzaskowski, in presidential elections last Sunday. Those elections were initially too close to call, with the final tally split 49.1% to 50.9% of the vote in favour of Trzaskowski's opponent, the Trump-supporting Karol Nawrocki, who was backed by the Conservative Nationalist Law and Justice Party. Law and Justice were in power until 2023, when they were defeated by Donald Tusk's Civic Platform, which promised to realign Poland with European liberal democratic norms after 8 years of rule of law backsliding. That agenda is now what is in question. This is how my colleague, Michal Gostkiewicz from DW's Polish department, described the choice with which voters had been faced in those presidential elections.
We have people who say that the state should be led by powerful men. That was actually an argument of many voters of Karol Nawrocki, that he's actually a powerful male. He's able to defend himself both physically, as he's famous for being a boxer, and taking parts in...
Allegedly a football hooligan as well, right?
Exactly. Honestly, one of my friends, a very well-known investigative reporter, did a series of texts where he proved that Nawrocki took part in one of the biggest and most famous brawls in the forest in the history of the Polish hooligan fights.
This was not on my list of questions to ask you, Michal, but listening to you there, do we need to talk about masculinity in the context of Polish politics?
Very, very. The statistics say it all. If only women voted, Trzaskowski would have nailed it. Not just because he's, I don't know, handsome or liberal or whatever. Women in Poland are more progressive. And of course, they have been hardened by the last years of law and justice rule, with the abortion ban, with the overall attitude of the right-wingers towards the role of a woman in society. We have a very conservative society that is rapidly changing. Why? Because the Polish society did not went through the 1968 revolution when it happened, because we were behind the Iron Curtain. And this happens a lot in many countries of the former Eastern Bloc. We are updating very fast through the social revolutions that the West went through over the past 40, 50 years. And that has repercussions. So most of the women in Poland would vote for Trzaskowski, but most of the men voted for Nawrocki. Why? Look at this. There's a generation of men who had their start in the 1990s or later, when Poland changed after the fall of the communist bloc. And if you were born in the city, got a good education, went to the right schools, knew the right people, you end up as a successful male. You got money, you got women, you got access to power, you got access to resources. Yeah, this is how it works. We're still tribes, right? But this was not, of course, available to all men. That's one thing. Second thing, there is this notion of manosphere in the West. Same happens in Poland because we are part of the global system, right? There are also millions of men in Poland who don't have a wife, who don't have a good job. This is the same social construct being created everywhere. This is the same social reality invading Poland, just like all the other countries, through social media. And most of the men voted for Nawrocki because he's really one of them.
given that there is this sort of absolute, you know, divide in Polish society, you know, you've just shown me how it can be split by gender. But, you know, even if you just look at the election results without doing that breakdown, you've got a country split down the middle between two diametrically opposed visions of the future. How on earth do you set about healing that?
Honestly, whenever I hear people talking about the possibility of healing that, well, I'm sorry for them. I might sound a bit pessimistic, but I look at how societies look in the age of social media. If you try to bury the divisions, you lose. If you dig deeper into them, you win, because you can play on people's emotions to gather the electorate. The lack of mobilization in the liberal camp was also another key to Trzaskowski's loss. 300,000 voters. That's one middle-sized Polish city. And the hope of the liberal camp before the second round was that these people who voted 2 years ago, will save democracy again. They did not go to vote. Why? Because for the past 2 years, the government did not respond to their hopes, did not fulfill its promises. And you can't blame everything on the current president, Andrzej Duda, for blocking everything. Yes, of course, he would have blocked the most important reforms. But what people saw was that the government isn't even attempting to introduce some reforms because they were sure that Andrzej Duda will block them. Well, okay, but you have to try.
Donald Tusk's decision to put it to the vote, to say, you know, look, I recognize what's happened. I recognize that this is really serious. And I recognize that this is a reflection not just on my presidential candidate, but on me, right? And on my program. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to put myself and, you know, by extension, my whole government to a vote of confidence, right? So you really get to decide, do you want this? Do you want what I'm offering? Do you want to be positioned towards Europe? Do you want a rollback of some of the backsliding on independence of judiciary and media and so on? You know, did you want that or not, right? So I feel like now we've got that. Or is this too optimistic?
Hard to say, but he couldn't do anything else after this election. Because what he has to show is that he still has support in the parliament. If he wins it, he can say, look, 2 years ago, you voted for me. We struck a deal and the deal was for 4 years. And I still have the support in the parliament to do it. I'm pretty sure Donald Tusk will win the confidence vote. And what can we see in the next 2 years? He's got actually two options. He can lead a caretaker government because and say, look, we can't do that because the new president is blocking us. Or he can go full throttle because he has got nothing to lose now. He can go with all the reforms he promised, put them on the vote, so that in 2 years he could say, look, we tried.
The stakes are incredibly high, not just for Poland, because other countries, thinking particularly of Hungary, were looking to Poland to see how it could be done, to see how you could take a country that has been in the grip of one party, has been shaped very much in its image, and you could reorientate it towards Europe and towards European liberal democracy, right? If Poland is showing how difficult it is right now, what are the lessons that could be learnt by a country like Hungary so that they do it things better?
Two types of lessons, one for the society and one for politicians. First, for politicians, be yourselves, don't try to be someone else. Who won in the Polish election? The one who was authentic. Regarding of his beliefs, whether I support them or not, that doesn't matter. He was authentic. The lessons for the society, it can't be a more Polish one. Whenever the authorities tell you to do something, resist like your life depend on it. We have it in our blood. We've been doing this for 200 years against the Russians and the Germans and the Austrians and everyone. Refuse and resist. This is in our blood. This is in our nature. Who won in the youngest generation? Karol Nawrocki. So the young generation of Poles voted for a more conservative candidate. Many of them voted for him because they feared that if Trzaskowski wins, the system will be complete. 2 years ago, the system was complete when Law and Justice was at power and they had Andrzej Duda. 2 years have passed, and now we have people voting against the current authorities for fear of system being complete and closed when all the authorities are from the same camp.
I was talking to Michelle Goskiewicz, EU correspondent for DW's Polish department. And we have another political earthquake coming up for you shortly in the form of the fall of the Dutch government. First, though, time for something different. This week, 25 people, including six minors, were charged in Paris over a series of kidnappings and attempted abductions targeting France's top crypto entrepreneurs and their families. We tasked our Paris correspondent, John Lawrenson, with investigating this bizarre and brutal crime wave for us.
An attempted kidnapping in broad daylight in a Paris street earlier this month. Three men dressed in black, ski masks pulled down over their faces, trying to pull a woman into the back of a van. Her husband, lying on top of her on the pavement and clinging onto her, makes it difficult for them, and when a shopkeeper intervenes, brandishing a fire extinguisher, they flee. The woman is the daughter of Pierre Noisa, boss of a cryptocurrency platform called Paymium. He had this to say on French TV.
Son mari et elle que j'ai vu hier se portent aussi bien que possible. Ils sont très forts.
My daughter and her husband are recovering well. They managed, with the help of neighbours alerted by the shouting, to foil this kidnapping. But it is an illustration of the situation we are now in. This sort of violence has become part of the daily lives of so many people now in France. There's a terror imposed by the drug gangs, a Mexicanization of France.
On parle parfois de narco-état. J'ai un collègue qui a parlé de mexicanisation de la France. Je pense qu'on est en plein dedans.
It is, in any case, the latest in a string of kidnappings, successful or not, that began at the start of the year, when five armed men, in the middle of the night, broke into the home of the 36-year-old founder of the Ledger crypto startup, David Ballon, and his wife Amandine, and kidnapped them. Shortly afterwards, Ballon's business partner Eric Larchevêque started receiving messages, including videos, from the kidnappers.
Message réclame une rançon. Ils disent que David.
The messages demanded a ransom. They said David had been captured and showed us a video. It clearly wasn't a film made using artificial intelligence. It was very realistic. And I immediately understood that it was serious.
The first film showed Ballon with a revolver held to his head and a meat cleaver against his neck. The ransom demanded was $11 million in cryptocurrency. Quickly after came a second film which showed the young crypto boss being mutilated, his little finger cut off.
This took us to a new stage of horror. I just tried to concentrate on saving David and Amandine. I immediately contacted law enforcement.
After consulting with the police and the judiciary, a third of the ransom was paid in cryptocurrency. But the funds were traced and the accounts they were transferred to blocked. And the GIGN Special Forces Unit freed the couple who were being held in separate locations in the Paris region. Seven arrests have been made so far. Amandine Ballon said the kidnappers called one of their number, who was giving the orders, the Marseillais, the man from Marseille. And investigators say there are similarities between this kidnapping and the modus operandi of the Marseille drug gangs. Vincent Gautrenot is a crime reporter with the Parisien newspaper.
On n'a pas affaire à des gros voyous, en tout cas pas jusqu'ici. Jusqu'ici, c'est des gens qui sont...
The people arrested are petty criminals, traffic offences, minor drug offences. The worst had done two short spells in prison. What one of them said was that he was promised 10,000 euros for keeping an eye on a drug delivery. It was only when he was taken to one of the hostages that he realized that the drug delivery was in fact a woman. Also, as with the Marseille drug gangs, there are firewalls between the people giving the orders and those following them. When they are arrested, they always say they were recruited to do such and such a job via the encrypted messaging services, Telegram or Signal, and that they never knew the identity of those who hired them.
On the 1st of May, the father of a well-known poker player and crypto investor was kidnapped in similar fashion. The kidnappers also cut off one of their captors' fingers. And here again, they tried and failed to obtain a cryptocurrency ransom. Vincent Gautrenot again.
For criminals, cryptocurrency has several advantages. If you hold up a bank, it's dangerous. If you burgle someone's house and steal jewelry, you have to sell it. But here you just have to ask someone to do a bank transfer. There is also the image that cryptocurrency has of being untraceable and that you can make it disappear very quickly and therefore get away fast with the loot. But what the David Belond affair has told us is that these funds are in fact traceable and can be tracked down.
C'est pas certain, je pense juste qu'ils y voient un moyen de gagner facilement de l'argent.
The Interior Minister has met with crypto entrepreneurs promising some protection measures. But perhaps their best hope that this hellish series of crimes will come to an end is what Gautrenot says, that while crypto may be easy to steal, it isn't easy to keep. John Lawrence, DW, Paris.
Digital wisdom from our Paris correspondent there. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock. The Dutch government has collapsed after the anti-Islam politician Geert Wilders withdrew his party's members from the cabinet. Faced with the choice between unstable minority rule or dissolving the remaining coalition, Prime Minister Dick Schoof opted for the latter option. His resignation was accepted by the Dutch king, Willem Alexander, on Wednesday. Needless to say, our Dutch-born correspondent Stefan Bos has been following events closely, and he explained to me that although ostensibly the fallout was over migration, there were other factors at play.
Yes, there is more to it. Of course, migration is a key reason, but truth be told, it was never a good marriage to begin with. After Wilders' anti-Islam PVV party won the elections in November 2023, months of difficult, tense negotiations followed. Only in July last year, the Party for Freedom, or the PVV, formed a right-wing coalition government with the populist Farmer Citizen Movement, that's the BBB, the centrist New Social Contract, the NSC, and the liberal conservative People's Party for Freedom, the VVD, that was sworn in only then. But the partners demanded a very high political price for the deal. They said Wilders could not become prime minister, in part because he had called Islam's prophet Muhammad a pedophile, Islam fascist and backward, and he even demanded bans on mosques, headscarves and the Quran. Now, in turn, they would help Wilders achieve Europe's strictest asylum and immigration policy. However, Wilders was dissatisfied with the slow pace of reforms. That is why, in recent days, he demanded the coalition partners sign his 10-point plan, and that included using the army to secure borders, turning back all asylum seekers, closing refugee hostels, sending Syrian refugees home, and suspending European Union asylum quotas. Now, Kate, I can tell you that the coalition partners refused. They said it was for the PVV's own Minister of Migration to come up with workable legislation that would meet the already agreed upon coalition accord on migration and other measures. Now, that's why Wilders decided then to pull the plug following the political quarrels, which he defended in a tough parliamentary debate in The Hague.
Nederland, voorzitter, schreeuwt om een harder asielbeleid. Maar onze voormalige coalitiepartners weigerden hiervoor te tekenen.
Okay, so migration is obviously key. It has to be said, Stefan, that Wilders' personality itself may have played a little bit of a role here. I mean, he's got quite a reputation as being difficult to work with, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think that's an understatement. Indeed, he has that. He's known as that. And I think also that's what the Prime Minister said. He appeared very irritated during this debate. It also comes in a month when the Netherlands is preparing for its largest summit in years. The Hague Summit will bring together the government leaders and heads of state of all 32 NATO military alliance member states, their partner countries and the European Union. And at the same parliamentary debate, Schoof appeared angry at Wilders.
Voorzitter, laat ik duidelijk zijn. De val van dit kabinet was wat mij betreft onnodig en onverantwoord.
Now, the Prime Minister says, let me be clear, in my view, the fall of this cabinet was unnecessary and irresponsible. We are facing major challenges, both nationally and internationally. And now, more than ever, decisiveness is required for our security, our resilience and the economy in a rapidly changing world.
Stefan, the political landscape in the Netherlands is, I think we can safely say at this point, rather fragmented. I mean, that's not unique in Europe by any means, but there is a sort of, you know, a quirk of the Dutch system in particular that lends itself to this. You've got something called the Polder model, which means that no party can rule alone anyway, and everything has to be done through consensus. Can you unpack that a bit for me? Because I have to admit, I've always found it slightly confusing.
Well, you know, the Polder model is really a historic term. It really dates back centuries ago when the Netherlands had to start to fight against the water. And we even still have now water boards. They are elected during general elections. And this Polder model basically says we have to work together somehow against the water, against the rising water as a seafaring nation. And that also has dropped into politics, if you will. So this Polder model is really the way how politics has to be done, also because there are so many parties, and there is not really one party, not even two parties, I would say, who have an absolute majority. So I think that in the coming months we will see tough campaigning, and there is talk that the Green Left Labour grouping could potentially be part of or even lead the next government with, for instance, the conservative liberal VVD party and perhaps even Christian Democrats. However, VVD will also try to place itself in the center of a government without the Green Left Labour Party if possible. Now, of course, Wilders will try to make a comeback. However, to secure a 76-seat majority and form another government, Wilders will need allies, which analysts say seems highly unlikely. In the meantime, after having offered his resignation and that of several PVV ministers to the Dutch king, Dick Schoof will serve as a caretaker prime minister as long as necessary.
Wow. Okay. So after this week's earthquake, we can expect further shifts in the Dutch political landscape, and that all happening within the context of a political system literally designed to keep out the rising tide. I'm going to leave listeners to think of their own metaphor there. But wow, I think what a note to end it on, Stefan.
Okay.
Our Dutch-born but Budapest-based correspondent Stefan Bos there. And speaking of Budapest, I'd like to put in a quick plug for next week's Inside Europe, where my guest will be Klára Dobrev, leader of Hungary's Democratic Coalition and former Vice President of the European Parliament. That'll be right here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock, in Germany.
Welcome to Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, a narrative podcast series that explores why teachers are leaving education and what can be done to stop the exodus. This season, we're getting a look at the year and the life of teachers from across the country through their audio journals.
I am Darcy Ostermiller.
This is Megan Overgaard.
This is Sophie V.
This is Charlie Blackwood.
This is Taylor Barron.
This is Iva Moss Ridman.
This is David Whisker. This is
Dan Morris.
This is Amanda Smith.
Look for Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, Season 2, a different kind of the same thing.
The ocean is vast, beautiful, and lawless. I'm Ian Urbina, back with an all-new season of The Outlaw Ocean. The stories we bring you this season are literally life or death. we look into the shocking prevalence of forced labor, mind-boggling overfishing, migrants hunted and captured. The Outlaw Ocean takes you where others won't. Available on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. It has been a dizzying week in terms of the Russian-Ukrainian war, not least because of the dramatic series of drone attacks which Ukraine managed to carry out on military targets deep within Russian territory. The Russian story that I want to bring you this week, however, is rather different, although its protagonists are in their way extremely daring. Because to be a woman challenging traditional gender roles is not an easy thing right now in Russia. In fact, discuss LGBTQ plus issues or even just a child-free lifestyle and you will be breaking the law. Even so, as Levi Bridges reports, Russians are still finding safe places to talk about these issues.
In the Russian region of Kaliningrad, members of a feminist collective gather to celebrate the group's anniversary. In between discussions on women's rights, the attendees socialize together as one of them films for social media. Events like these are getting rarer. Since Russia invaded Ukraine, Putin's government has embraced an ultra-conservative rhetoric. Women who I talk to in Russia say the Kremlin has launched a complete crackdown on women's rights that's made it harder just to hold events like these. Дарья Яковлева is a feminist activist in Russia. Яковлева says lots of Russians, young people especially, are embracing the government's conservative messaging, and gender-based violence has increased.
For years, our feminist movement has worked to raise awareness about issues like domestic violence in Russia. But now there is clear pushback. We've seen a rise in conservative movements that promote a traditional view of women as wives and mothers. Feminists feel incredibly unsafe right now.
Attempts to silence feminism directly serve the Russian state. Last year, Putin said on television that Russians need to have more kids. Experts predict that steady population decline will hurt Europe's economy. When there aren't enough workers paying taxes, then it becomes difficult for countries to support pensioners. Many European governments are now adopting policies to increase the population, but Russia has gone extreme. In a Russian news report, Putin awards a woman the title of Mother Heroine, the honorary title for Russian women who have given birth to at least 10 children, was first given out by Stalin during the Second World War. The awards fell out of fashion after the Soviet Union collapsed, but Putin revived the tradition not long after Russia invaded Ukraine. The mother thanks Putin for the award, which comes with €1 million in prize money, about 11,000 euros. But lots of Russians I spoke with say they have no intention of having kids while Putin is still president. I talked over the phone with one young woman who, like others in this story, didn't want to give her name because she worries about being punished by the state for talking about issues like a woman's right to choose. She says even Russian schools are pushing this idea that women should have children.
I was in a taxi recently with a driver who supports the government, and the entire ride he was telling me how the future depends on women to fulfill their traditional roles while our soldiers are out on the front.
Other Russians tell me that birth control is harder to get now. A recent law that outlaws what the Kremlin calls child-free propaganda could make it illegal for a woman without children to post happy pictures about her life on Instagram. In theory, even that could be promoting a child-free lifestyle.
One woman in Russia tells me lots of women still discuss issues like reproductive rights openly in public spaces, like cafes or bars. On the internet, women in Russia communicate with each other about feminism and women's rights in groups on platforms like Facebook or Telegram. But now, that's changing.
The risks right now are huge. You could face criminal charges by just participating in a Telegram chat.
Women in Russia told me that they're shifting away from Russian platforms online and forming closed groups where users remain anonymous. The woman I spoke to in Russia who had that uncomfortable interaction with the taxi driver says she's now talking with women in private groups where only trusted members are allowed. In the groups, she says, it feels like the laws don't fully apply because women discuss any topic openly. They know the other participants are trustworthy. Another woman who works with a feminist organization in Russia has already spent hours deleting posts from their social media accounts to comply with the new laws. But they haven't yet erased ones about issues like contraception.
We don't want to erase all of the posts. We don't want to disappear under repression, because that's exactly what the system wants from us.
But still, there is far less information out there. When you Google in Russian about issues like the challenges of raising young children, you get a lot of results now from pro-Kremlin Russians celebrating the joys of parenthood. Russian women I spoke to say the government's policies and economic effects of the war are a big reason why they're choosing not to have kids right now. Last year, Russia's birth rate sunk to the lowest it's been since Putin took power, about a quarter of a century ago. And efforts to censor Russia's internet haven't completely succeeded. Songs from a popular Russian band called Noise MC, which has come out against the war, are still readily available on YouTube. The title of one song, Child Free. Levi Bridges, DW.
Those ocean sounds are telling me that it is time for us to leave solid ground behind and cast out into the unknown.
The sort of congealing concept is this extra legal realm that's largely out of reach of normal rules or governments or enforcement.
That's the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ian Urbina, back this week with a second series of the haunting investigative podcast Outlaw Ocean. It's a listening experience rather like the sea itself. Deep, porous, sometimes dreamlike and haunting, sometimes alarming and dangerous. Almost two-thirds of the world's surface is ocean, and yet we know so little about it. More than that, the oceans are increasingly the sites on which so many of our terrestrial battles are being fought out. Think climate change, fishing rights, pollution, underwater communications infrastructure, and, of course, borders and migration.
Nearly 200 migrants were brought to the Italian port of Pozzallo early Monday aboard an Italian Coast Guard ship sailing under the Frontex.
Frontex, the European border agency, has described its concern about what it calls a steady increase in irregular migration across.
To pay more money to have the EU's external border safeguarded, meaning more money for Frontex.
Frontex accused donor-funded charity rescue ships of colluding with traffickers.
Yes, episode one of the new series of Outlaw Ocean begins on our own watery doorstep, where the laws-based democracies of the EU meet the lawless space of the sea. It's the dark and dirty story of how the EU has spent hundreds of millions of euros outsourcing its immigration control in the Mediterranean to the Libyan Coast Guard. And if Coast Guard sounds benign, do not be fooled. The Libyan Coast Guard is really little more than a mercenary militia, intercepting migrant boats on the EU's behalf, then forcing the passengers back to shore.
Does he have a ballpark sense of how many shots he heard fired during the whole incident?
Combien de tirailles est-ce que tu as entendu?
Ah non, plusieurs, j'ai pas calculé.
Mais trois, cinq?
C'était plus de cinq balles.
Plus que cinq?
Plus de cinq balles.
Minimum five, more than five.
And was the shooting, did it occur over the course of 1 minute, 10 minutes?
Ça a duré longtemps. Ça a duré longtemps, c'était plus de 10 minutes.
No, more whoa, than ten, whoa, more than
whoa,
10 minutes.
Whoa.
Once back on land, the captured migrants are disappeared into a notorious system of detention centres in Libya, where torture, rape, extortion and slavery are not only endemic, but a fundamental part of the business model.
I took a team of journalists, myself and an editor and a videographer, translator and a doc filmmaker. We all went to Libya to investigate the situation of how the EU is funding and orchestrating a gulag of detention centers in Libya. Our goal was to figure out how this system works and sort of what are the real human impacts of that experience of getting captured at sea and brought back to shore.
But Ian and his team got more than they bargained for. Very soon, they themselves became part of the story.
It was a successful investigative effort, and maybe that's why what happened to us happened to us. But a week into our reporting, we were taken captive by a Libyan militia and disappeared into a prison because they were not happy with the journalism we were attempting to do.
Honestly, of all the scenarios of vertiginous terror that I can imagine as a journalist, that right there is probably the worst. To find out what happened, you will just have to listen to the Outlaw Ocean podcast. What I can tell you, though, is that Ian and his team are now safely back on land, although, as he told me, the sea still seems to have him in its thrall.
I don't tend to get seasick very easily, but I do get land sick, which is to say when my internal pendulum switches so as to adjust and accommodate the swaying of the ocean. It has a tough time switching back when I get on land, and my body keeps swaying even though I'm on solid ground, and that causes a reverse seasickness. So sometimes I'm sick when I get back to land, which is an interesting metaphor.
A metaphor for the pull of the sea, maybe. It is certainly the watery thread which runs through the Outlaw Ocean podcast. And for all the ugliness of the crimes that Ian and his team uncover, there is always wonder too.
It really is like outer space. It's expanse. I know it's so, I don't know, goofy to say it, but whales are big. I mean, they're just monsters. They're so huge and so beautiful. There is beauty in going out there and seeing what it feels like.
You can hear Ian Urbina's Tales of the Sea on the Outlaw Ocean podcast. Season 2 is available in podcast feeds as of June 6th. And our focus on borders, boundaries, and those who end up caught between them continues now as we turn to Italy. The Mediterranean country has long been on the front lines of the European border crisis, and under Giorgia Meloni's far-right government is pursuing a hardline approach to immigration. That makes the operating space for the NGOs and charities trying to help new arrivals even tougher than before. And it's not just those arriving via the Mediterranean route who need help either. Over 180,000 Ukrainian refugees have arrived in Italy since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion back in 2022. Our reporter, Angelo Van Schaik, paid a visit to the San Mifo Medical Centre in Rome, which has been treating refugees and asylum seekers for almost 20 years now. SAMIFO stands for Sanità Migranti Forzati, which means healthcare for forced migrants. Some 2,000 patients per year are helped by this organisation, which is located just a stone's throw away from the central train station in Rome.
It's quite crowded this Monday morning in the SAMIFO centre. People from all over the world are patiently waiting at the front office for their turn. Mondays are always busy, says founder Giancarlo Santone, as in the weekend the center is closed.
Abbiamo il cuore del Samifo, che è il front office dove ci sono mediatori e mediatrici.
This is the beating heart of Samifo, the front office with our cultural mediators who speak in total 27 languages. Most of them are from foreign descent: Iraq, Eritrea, Turkey, Afghanistan. These are the most important people here.
Santone is founder and director of Samifo, which claims to be Europe's only publicly funded medical center exclusively aimed at treating post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma among asylum seekers and refugees.
Everyone who comes here has a legal status. They have the documents to stay in Italy. A large part of them live in migrant centres in and around Rome and are sent here by the centre managers. Besides that, there's a lot of word of mouth, as we are quite well known by now.
Samifo is located in the only newly built building on a street with beautiful late 19th century palaces, just a few hundred metres from Termini, Rome's central station. The center is relatively small. Besides the front office, there are two consultation rooms, one with a female doctor and one with a male doctor, a small waiting room, and Santone's own office. In addition, there's a special room for more delicate cases, and gynecologists and psychologists are available for victims of torture and violence. All of this is housed in approximately 80 square meters. Until the war in Ukraine started, the center was mainly visited by men. Now the patients are 60% men and 40% women.
Eccolo, ricominciamo.
Dr. Antonio Spina is calling the next patient. Svetlana from Ukraine pushes her 15-year-old daughter Valeria into the consultation room. Valeria has a congenital condition which confines her to a wheelchair. Svetlana tells Dr. Spina that Valeria was hit in the head with a basketball during gym class, and now she has a weird bump on the back of her neck. Cultural mediator Olga translates. Dr. Spina reassures Svetlana there's nothing to worry about. Mother and daughter are from the east of Ukraine, not far from Kharkiv. 3 years ago, Bambin Gesù, the Vatican's children's hospital, invited Valeria to come to Rome as it was impossible to continue her treatment in Ukraine due to the war. Svetlana is glad to be in Italy, but her thoughts are still in Ukraine.
My mother and my sister are still there, and the situation is difficult. There are still bombardments, and houses are destroyed. I'm scared for my family.
Antonio Spina has been involved with the Samifo project since the beginning, out of passion and commitment, he says.
Normally, patients at an Italian GP are much older, over 50. Most of my patients are between 25 and 45 years of age. There are a lot of cases of diabetes and hypertension due to the sudden change in diet. If you change from a rice-based diet in, for instance, Asia to a European diet, that causes problems, as the European diet has a higher glycemic index.
But it's not only physical problems Dr. Spina is facing.
We see a lot of post-traumatic stress caused by violence and torture. One out of five of my patients is a victim of torture, either in their country of origin or in transit countries like Libya.
One of the people seeking help for the psychological problems is John from Algeria.
I lost my wife.
John tells me that he had come to Samifo because he's really struggling mentally. His wife died when they were trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea, and he has no idea whether his son is alive or not. He's still looking for him. It's a lot to cope with, and John is hoping that here he will be able to get advice. Perhaps even talk to someone who will know what to do.
Advice, to know what to do.
The Samifo Center medics have been helping their patients for almost 20 years now. And despite rising anti-migrant sentiment in the country,
Founder Giancarlo Santone is hopeful that their work will continue.
Fortunately, we don't feel that pressure, neither socially nor politically. And that's a good thing for the people who work here and the people we assist. In Italy, healthcare is a right for everyone, so we don't feel that pressure. I think that whoever governs and has a bit of knowledge about the refugees and their problems doesn't have any reason to obstruct an excellent service like Samifo.
Over the last two decades, the amount of migrants reaching Italy has increased from around 22,000 a year in 2006 to more than 150,000 in 2023. But the little clinic in the center of Rome continues to offer people medical assistance, psychological help, and opportunities to get on with their life away from home. Other regions in central Italy start to see the benefits of a center like Samifo and thinking about copying the initiative. Angelo van Schaik, DW, Rome, Italy.
And there is more hope in the dark still to come. We're off for a kick around with the Spanish refugee national football team just after the break. One of the real pleasures of my job is getting to know our network of correspondents around the continent. And if you were to ask me which of them was most likely to pitch me a heartwarming sports story, then I wouldn't hesitate. I'd tell you it would have to be our Madrid correspondent, Ashish Sharma. And so it was in this case. Would we like a story about the Spanish refugee national football team, he asked. And obviously we said yes. Here's what you need to know. The Spanish Commission for Refugees, which exists to protect the rights of those who arrive in the country, also works in projects around social exclusion. Recently, its refugee football team was officially recognised and embraced by the Spanish Olympic Committee. Made up of migrants from all over the world, the team plays in a local league in Madrid in the hope that through football, locals and refugees can build a better understanding. Over to Ashish Sharma.
Muy buenas tardes a todos. Bienvenidos al Comité Olímpico Español.
Inspired by the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, which set up an Olympic refugee team, Spain has been at the forefront of integration programs in sports for refugees, and the Spanish Olympic Committee has been leading the way. It helped in the funding and construction of the world's first ever sports centre dedicated to refugees built in the suburbs of Madrid in 2021. The centre is named after Alejandro Blanco, the president of the Spanish Olympic Committee, and in collaboration with the Spanish Commission for Refugees, it has opened its doors to the refugee football team.
Hoy hablamos del fútbol, pero
we started to think about how we could help refugees together through sport. Today we talk about football, but I won't forget that we also have helped basketball players, athletes, boxers, tennis players. We have done many things trying to help refugees. We are not looking for a medal here. There is no first, second or third place.
According to the IOC, there are more than 120 million people worldwide who've been displaced from their homes.
Buenas tardes. La verdad, desde el club, cuando me hablaron de...
Alan Neom is a professional footballer who plays for the Madrid-based La Liga side Getafe. He was born in France, but his mother hails from Cameroon. As his career established at international level, he opted to play for Cameroon instead of France. Neom says sport plays a vital part in helping refugees integrate.
It's very important because it will help them for get involved in the life, you know, in the Spanish life. And I hope that will help them to find a job or find a better life. I think there will be a good integration. They will have a good integration with the Spanish people, and the football or the sport will help them.
22-year-old Destiny Umufuman from Nigeria is one of the refugee players. It took him 6 years to get from Nigeria to Spain, and in the last 2 years he's been trying to build a new life here in Madrid, and playing football has become an important part of that.
Life has been good, I would say. Since I got here, like I've been able to study, you know, also try to integrate into the system and also learn the culture and the language and everything, and also the football team as well. And also, I am in the process of achieving my goals and my dreams.
So you're playing for this football team. How important is that for you as someone who, you know, has just come here and is in a different culture, a different language?
So it's very important for me because at the end, we all have the same stories, the same district, because we are all in the same situation. So the football team for me is like a way to... It's like another way to find out that, okay, I have a brother from another country, it doesn't matter, from Venezuela, from Morocco, from Nigeria also, that is also in the same situation with me. I mean, like similar situations, all the same situation, that is also trying to integrate into a new system, trying to learn a new language. And also, for me, it's very important because at the end of the day, I don't have anything doing at the weekends. So when I know that I have a plan during the weekend, so it also helps me to disconnect a little bit about what is going on back in my country.
But what about integration with Spanish people? Because it's a team of refugees, so do you get much connection or contact with actually local Spanish people?
We are playing in a private league, so we have a lot of connection with the locals, and we like talk with them, and sometimes we also have friends, we make friends in between ourselves. At the end of the day, football is everything. Football is a language. It's a way to interact with people. It's friendship. It's love. And football don't has any barrier. There's no limit when it comes to football.
Veronica Cheble is the marketing director of the Spanish Commission for Refugees. She says creating a team sport environment is a positive way to help individual refugees overcome their traumas.
It's a place, safety place for them to play and to forget things and to heal, to belong to something after leaving all behind, to belong to a team. They don't feel alone trying to get integrated in the society. So this team is also opening a door to tell all the stories behind the team.
The support of the Spanish Olympic Committee has been vital to refugees. It's hoped that moments like this will not only help refugees feel integrated, but also be part of the process to help them recover from the traumas that have taken them so far away from their homes and families. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
I think I might just be beginning to understand why they call it the beautiful game. We're nearing the end of the show, but there is just time for... Congratulations to everyone who knew that the code name for the 1944 D-Day landings was Operation Overlord. This week, in honour of Pride Month, what we want to know is, which country was the first in the world to lawfully establish same-sex marriage? Was it the USA, the Netherlands, Switzerland, the UK, or Iceland? Head on over to Spotify to take part in the poll if you think you know the answer or if you just want to take a guess. That is it for today. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, together with my colleague Sam Baker. Additional thanks to Lavinia Pitu. Our sound engineer was Siad Abu Sleiman. Our email address is insideeurope@dw.com, and we really do check that inbox regularly and love reading your ideas and comments for the show, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. We're also, as always, massively grateful for likes, shares and ratings on whichever platform you use, because these are really the things that help other listeners to find us. Thanks. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.